It's 5:06 and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Verrett. Members of the Ho-Chunk Nation work hard to sustain their culture and beliefs, even creating an entire branch of government dedicated to preserving Ho-Chunk as a living language.
Apprentice Arlene Thunder Blackdeer is one of 15 language teachers who work with a fluent Ho-Chunk speaker in the Master Apprentice Program. She shares her story in this episode of Wisconsin Life.
When I am driving to work, I feel like maybe my ancestors are there cheering me on. I'm sure they are. Obviously, they want their language to go on. They want our language to go on. My name is Arlene Blackdeer, and I am a Ho-Chunk language apprentice. The Ho-Chunk Master Apprentice Program is basically made up to create younger speakers that will go on teaching the language and culture. I work with Wahopini Skyinga, that's Aurelia Hopinka, and she grew up in the Dells area, and she was raised by her mom and dad, and she was also sent to her grandparents' house. They were sent to the elders to be taught what the elders know, so they can carry on those stories and those ways. I remember hearing from my elders, and even now to this day, that when our language dies, that's going to be the end of our world. And when I was younger, I really did not understand that. Now that I'm older, I see that. I see it because it's so close, coming to an end. So I thought, out of respect for my elders and everything they've gone through, that's the least I can do for them.
And what's tomorrow? I usually say it when I say see you later. What is it? Heinegi. Anybody remember October?
Or
what it means? Without
looking? It's
like
the season of the deer.
Deer pie.
Deer
pie. So how do you say deer?
Cha. I do see us raising awareness to the high school students so at some point they can go on to further their learning, where we're building their language and giving them the basics so they can go out on their own and possibly become an apprentice.
Chahe wakshumwida.
Chahe wakshumwida.
Punch wihiragnida.
Are they going to be fluent after they get done with high school? No. Will they know a lot more than what they went in there with? Probably. I guess if I wanted to say anything to anybody in any Native community, is get involved. Get involved in your language, get involved in your culture. It makes you who you are as a person, you know, or as a community. Don't let it get to where it's almost to the point where you can't bring it back. And I feel like we're nearing that, but with the efforts that we're making, I feel in my heart that we can actually do it.
This story was produced by Finn Ryan of the Wisconsin Media Lab for The Ways. Learn more and see the video at theways.org.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. This episode is produced in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council.
Coming up later in the program, we'll take a look at a proposed casino in the state and hear what's at stake for Wisconsin residents and the tribes.
But first, we explore a growing trend in urban areas around the country. Our next guest says we've embarked on an experiment to rid our cities of children.
Joining us now is Joel Kotkin, a professor of urban studies and a fellow at Chapman University, also a contributing editor to City Journal and a columnist for Forbes. And Joel, welcome to Central Time.
It's my pleasure.
So as we mentioned in the intro, you've written that we've embarked on an experiment to rid our cities of children. Tell us what's going on there.
Well, I mean, I wouldn't quite say, you know, like if somebody sat down and sort of said, okay, how are we going to get rid of the kids? But what we've done is by pushing certain policies and by not doing other things, providing for, good education, we really have made it very difficult for families except the very wealthy and, frankly, those who have support from the state to stay in cities. And so what you find is that cities are becoming increasingly the residents of, the rich, the poor, the people who are and the people who don't have kids. Whether they're married or not, and that the difference in the rates of marriage and childlessness are actually, you know, quite shocking. If you take a look at a map, for instance, of where children are, let's say in the Bay Area or in New York, the more dense, more expensive core has many fewer children than the further out you get.
Is it just a matter of these dense areas cost a lot and it's hard to pay to live in these areas and pay to raise children at the same time?
Well, I think that's certainly a lot of it. I mean, particularly the more successful places like, let's say, Seattle or Portland or San Francisco or Manhattan or even the, you know, the upscale parts of Chicago, the ability to buy a place or even rent a place and get enough space to raise children is very, very difficult. And then if you add the cost, for instance, of going to private school, then it really becomes very difficult for most families.
Can you give us an example of some of the cities where children and families are on the way out?
Well, certainly the lowest percentage is actually would probably be Washington, D.C., Manhattan, San Francisco, Seattle would probably be at the top of the list. In Washington, D.C., about 70% of adult-age women of childbearing age have never had kids. Majority of households in Manhattan aren't single. They're not even married. So these are probably the places where you see the fewest. Now, you do sometimes see, for instance, I did a study on Manhattan. What we found is up to the age of 5 or 6, it was about the national average, and then it just plummets. Because, you know, when the kids are really little, being, you know, they don't eat up that much space, mm-hmm. and you're not worried so much about their education. And actually being in the city can sometimes actually be fairly convenient. It's when the kids get ambulatory that you get in trouble. And if you have the second child, then you're really in trouble.
Is there something that cities are doing to, say, reach out to the young professionals and not doing to reach out to the families and have amenities and facilities for kids?
Well, if you look at where the priorities are in most cities these days, you know, it's downtown development, it's residential apartment, you know, multifamily housing, which ends up being usually multi-single apartments. There's a lot of investment in entertainment venues, and, you know, in trying to create kind of, you know, in some, you know, of course, we all remember the incredibly absurd Cool Cities campaign that Michigan had, you know, with Governor Granholm, you know, Cool Detroit, Cool Flint, that whole business. So I think they are certainly reaching out to that group. And then, frankly, the stuff that families need is expensive and difficult. Public safety is usually important, and education. And urban education seems to be the thing that they really are having the hardest time dealing with. I mean, the only city I think that's made a real turnaround is New Orleans.
Oh, interesting. What has New Orleans done?
They've gone pretty much all charter. But remember, they had, if you want to call it that, an advantage. I do a lot of work in New Orleans. Mm. Everything got wiped out, so they got to start all over again. And so they were able to make some very, very radical reforms. But in most American cities, you know, the teachers' unions are very powerful. The educational bureaucracy is very powerful. And, of course, and you have a very, very difficult time in changing the way the schools are run. Look, if a person like Bloomberg, with all his money and bluster and media power, could not really take on and change and really improve the New York City schools, you got to imagine that most mere mortals serving in city councils and mayors are going to have a tougher time.
Now, one of the things that really struck me about your article was that you said that the creative class, you know, that was a term that Richard Florida popularized, right, for sort of, you know, people who are into creative, you know, young people and the childless, people like that. Anyway, that they live in these cities like tourists and that they function that way more as tourist spots instead of, you know, having the cornerstone of the city be the school, the church, the community center. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, this is some really wonderful work that's been done by Terry Nichols Clark out of the University of Chicago. And he talks about the city as entertainment machine. That people now, let's say, move to Chicago, they don't really move, you know, for even economic reasons. They move for lifestyle reasons. And so the city becomes kind of an entertainment venue. You know, San Francisco is referred to sometimes as a Disneyland for adults. Or a good friend of mine who's a native San Franciscan says a theme park for restaurants. So, you know, you have great restaurants and you have, you know, really good entertainment venues and you have, you know, great little coffee shops and wonderful bars and all these kinds of things, which become the center of the sort of urban identity compared to, let's say, the church or the school or even the neighborhood park. And so you get a very different approach to what matters and what doesn't between a city that is, if you will, you know, becoming childless, or of course the term they like to use now is child-free, which always reminds me of, like, gluten-free. I don't know why child-free is any less offensive than childless, but I've always told to use child-free, which I don't get it. But you know, what you really have is you have cities that have really become dependent on this kind of population. And as opposed to, let's say, take a city that is gaining children, you know, Salt Lake City, Houston, Dallas, Fort Worth, these cities are much more and regions are much more trying to accommodate children much more. And, you know, in the case of Houston, they've done some very good things on the education front as well. But I just think, you know, it changes the nature of politics in a city when the majority of the electorate is made up of people who don't have children.
We're talking with Joel Kotkin about the growing trend of the childless city or child-free city. We want to hear from you. Do you think there's room for kids and their families in the city? Would you want to raise children in a major city, or did you move out from a city when you had kids? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll take your calls right after the break.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Thanks, Kristen. I'm Rob Verrett.
And I'm Veronica Ricker. We're talking right now about the rise of the childless city with Joel Kotkin. And we want to hear from you. Are you a parent who's raised children in a city? And what do you think were the pluses and minuses of that experience? And do you think that some cities are becoming less child-friendly? Do you understand why there is some flight from families from the cities? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. And Joel, tell us, what do you think cities could do if they want to bring children back into the mix more?
Well, I think an important thing, and I think this is particularly useful for cities in the middle part of the country, is there are a lot of great neighborhoods that have really good, if you will, good bones. You know, they have nice houses, they have backyards, they're in the city itself. So they were built probably initially as, if you will, early suburbs. They're perfectly good for raising a family, but you have a problem with the schools. And most cities seem to be interested in putting their money into sports stadia and convention centers and arts districts, and not really trying to focus on the neighborhoods. A colleague of mine just bought a really nice house right near the Cleveland Zoo for $76,000. I would be urging, and I have been urging, mayors, particularly in your part of the country where things are relatively affordable and where the cities never were that dense to start with, that you could go and try to save these neighborhoods and try to say, look, we're going to, you know, whether it is bringing charter schools, getting crime down, improving the parks, these neighborhoods have been child-friendly for generations. And the problem has been that they've not been the high priority of most city administrations. If you look at where money goes, like even with Detroit now, what are they going to do? They're going to build a Red Wings stadium and put a bunch of, you know, hip, cool stuff downtown. Meanwhile, the neighborhoods, you know, get basically nothing.
Is it because it's just not as sexy as you know, having a stadium with your name on the plaque?
Well, sexy is one word. It also would have to do with who gets to benefit. You know, there are you know, billionaire owners of teams. There are corporations that want to have box seats. There are construction unions that want to be in on a big project. let's say fixing up a neighborhood, maybe a bunch of craftsmen coming in and helping and fixing up homes, but you're not going to get, you know, 500 members of the Carpenters Union working on a gigantic project. So there are all these people, and then of course there are all these people on Wall Street who make money making cities go into more and more debt for bigger and bigger projects. So there's a strong economic interest in let's say convention centers or in these sort of big ticket items, and you know the improving of a neighborhood is a slower, less obvious thing, and the neighborhoods don't have the power that the real estate developers have and the big unions have.
So then, Joel, tell us what do cities lose when the families leave? If you're just making the argument for all the jobs that some of this flashier stuff attracts, what do cities lose?
Well, I think they lose a certain essential character of what it has been to be a city throughout time. They begin to become, I think one guy at Wharton called them they become productive resorts, you know, where, yes, you get some very well-educated people, you get some very talented people, but there's no soul to it. I don't know how else to put it. A city loses its feel of being a place where people actually grow up and stay and feel committed. So you also lose a little bit of that as well, and you become much more of a transient city. And I think that you you lose a certain kind of diversity because very often what you'll find is you'll have young people, childless couples, and then a lot of elderly that are left behind when their kids have moved out. And so the whole sort of, if you want to put, the age diversity, I think is something that's very valuable. And if you go to a cities like in Tokyo now and in parts of Europe, you're just astounded by the lack of children. It's like really obvious.
We'll go to the phones now. We've got Terry on the line in Black River Falls. Terry, hi.
Hey, guys.
What do you think about this?
I couldn't agree more. The dissipation of children in cities is overwhelming at this point in time. I mean, we've even gone as far as putting wireless internet in McDonald's and replacing play areas for the kids. I mean, I have four boys myself, and all they want to do is find some place for the wireless internet and not be kids. And I don't want my kids around that. That's horrible. We've lost the entire concept of what it's like to be a child, and all we can focus on is business. And it's terrible to see.
Thanks for the call, Terry. So prioritizing in cities and elsewhere, it sounds like, the business life over having room to be kids.
Yeah, and I think that's why, for instance, if a city wants to be attractive to families like what Dallas is doing with the Trinity River Project or in Houston with the Bayous or Raleigh, these are all cities that have been gaining children, is putting a lot of money into a 38-mile river woods trail. These things are really important, and I think a big part of being a child, I think, is hanging out, going to a park, being around trees, being around birds, and I think that we lose that when we decide that the city has to be high density and we put our priorities in other areas.
So it sounds like green space is a big part of what you're advocating for cities to do, like beef up the park systems. Is that a big chunk of it?
A very big part of it. I in doing research, I spent a lot of time in a place called Irvine, California, which is a rather large, you can call it a suburb, but it actually has more jobs than more people go into work there than leave there. But you ask the residents, why are you there? And they'll say, schools and parks. When I went to a new subdivision out in the San Bernardino area called Eastvale, schools and parks. It's almost without exception, schools and parks, unless you have a crime problem, and then it's safety. I mean, those three things are such very basic city services, things that a city can give to families. And unfortunately, a lot of cities don't provide that and don't prioritize it.
Joel, in just our last 40 seconds or so, you mentioned some success stories. Do you think city leaders are buying what you're selling?
I think there are some. I think there are cities that are still growing and getting families that are sensitive to it. But frankly, the urban debate has moved so much into sort of hip, cool, creative class, high density, that is completely inimical to what the vast majority of families want. So I suppose there's a lot of missionary work that has to be done.
Well, Joel, thank you so much for being here today. Appreciate your time.
My pleasure. Thank you.
We've been talking to Joel Kotkin, a professor of urban studies at Chapman University, as well as a contributing editor to City Journal, and he's a columnist for Forbes.
Coming up next, we'll take a look at a proposed casino in the state and hear what's at stake for Wisconsin residents and tribes. I'm Rob Verrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Verrett. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll talk about Martin Luther King Jr.'s I Have a Dream speech and what makes it great, according to our guest.
But first, the Menominee Tribe's plans for an off-reservation casino in Kenosha is causing controversy among Wisconsin's tribes.
Federal officials have approved the plan. Now, Governor Walker needs to sign off on the project before it moves forward.
But Governor Scott Walker announced his approval hinges on tribal consensus, along with a few other key points.
Supporters of the casino spoke at the state capitol earlier today. Our guest now is Paul DeMain, producer for IndianCountryTV.com. Paul, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Good afternoon.
So the Bureau of Indian Affairs gave the thumbs up. That's one step, but the story's not done. What's controversial about this proposed casino?
Well, there's going to always be a little bit of controversy around any of these projects having to do with casinos when they are going to be proposed to be located off the reservation, first of all, because it takes a lot for the public to understand the concept of why a tribe has reserve rights or capabilities to do that in the first place. In this particular case, you have a little bit of an added controversy in regards to the joint use area, which is the Kenosha area. In fact, that whole eastern coast of the state of Wisconsin going down towards southern Wisconsin, which was utilized by several tribes, so that several of those tribes have what you call status, historic status. While the U.S. government attempted to really define some of these areas by saying, whose area is that and where are you, and there's a border between them, a lot of the tribes never engaged in that kind of activity in that sense. They didn't have the boundaries. There was joint-use hunting areas, joint-use fishing areas, and those kinds of things. So both the Potawatomi tribe and the Forest County Potawatomi and the Menominee Nation have both utilized that area of Kenosha historically, both lay claim to it. And you have a casino, an off-reservation casino in the valley area of downtown Milwaukee that the Potawatomis are going to protect. And on the other hand, you got the Menominee Nation who have a casino in northern Wisconsin that functions quite like a lot of the other casinos, that makes quite a bit of money during the summer season, and during the winter is either a lost leader or a break-even proposition. They're trying to expand their economic opportunities and capabilities to serve a growing group of people on the reservation by reaching out to this opportunity that is there for them.
As I mentioned, one of the conditions that Governor Walker is looking for is tribal consensus among the Wisconsin tribes. Given the things you just mentioned, the disagreement over the shared use area and the idea that this might be competing with existing casinos, is it likely that the tribes will reach a consensus here?
Well, that whole is a preposterous idea coming from a governor that doesn't look for consensus on any other single issue that he's ever dealt with. Why he would apply a consensus notion to the 11 Wisconsin tribes when you pass a mining bill by one vote and jamming it through the legislative process is almost laughable. I wish he would utilize that standard for other things in the state of Wisconsin. So on the face of it, I think the governor is proposing something that is pretty much impossible to achieve under the circumstances, and I think he knows that, and I think he's playing that. And so I don't see the governor trying to sit down and say we need a consensus on this stuff, and I will decide if everyone decides that the Menominee Nation needs a casino down there. This decision has to be made on the merits of the Menominee Nation's application. That's what it has to be made on. And the Potawatomi have some legitimate concerns. So if there are issues and a consensus needs to be reached, it really needs to be reached between those two parties without all the other elements that you can throw in it and say, well, but the people in Red Cliff don't want it, therefore I'm going to make a decision to go against it for whatever reason. I think, first of all, that's a proposition that isn't going to work. The idea of this situation is that tribes can reach out and utilize some of their historic ties in a positive way. It's been done by the Fond du Lac tribe with the Fond du Luth Casino in Duluth. It's been done with the Forest County Potawatomi in their historic area in Milwaukee. And really, it comes down to an economic balancing act. From my point of view only, the Potawatomis are going to argue against that casino. The Menominees are going to argue for it. My wish is that the Potawatomis and Menominees would sit down with each other and figure out what's best for them collectively, because they have a real long history of intermarriage and intertribal politics in that area. And really, that is the battle of the minds. What's fair and equitable between those two entities? Now, that's not how they approach this project. The Menominees have said they're going to pursue it. The Potawatomis have said they're going to fight against it. We can expect to see pro and con advertisements on the merits of that to try to sway public and political opinion. But frankly, the Bureau of Indian Affairs has had to look at this from a number of points of view. If they have agreed with the project, then they apparently have made some kind of a decision that says that this project will not infringe upon the economic viability of the Milwaukee casino, therefore it should proceed, that there's plenty of revenue in that area for both of those tribes to share. Otherwise, I believe they wouldn't have made the decision that they've already come to a conclusion to.
Now, this casino has been in the works or speculated about since, I think, the mid-90s. Why just now are we hearing this ruling from the Bureau of Indian Affairs?
Well, because it's a long, long process. You have to meet all kinds of standards of needs. You have to have local cooperation, which it obviously has. Otherwise, the Bureau of Indian Affairs would have nixed it. You're looking at county, town. You're looking at the issue of investment equity. You're looking at the politics of the entire project being given to now the governor of the state of Wisconsin decide, because the governor of the states has to agree with this project as well. He's got to accept it. If you remember, Scott McCallum turned down the Lakota Ray tribe, and that might have been a joint project over in the Hudson Dog Track. And so the tribe went through this entire process, got it approved at the Bureau of Indian Affairs level. The governor nixed that project. So I know that the Menominees have a huge job to do to convince this governor to approve this project, consider the dynamics of the other tribes in the impacted area, in particular the Potawatomis. It's a long, long, drawn-out process. It's just not done frivolously. Otherwise, you'd have casinos all over the United States in all kinds of places. And I know the BIA is following those regulations and guidance, and those regulations and guidance have changed over the years from the time when I was with the Governor Earl and the Potawatomis first made their application in the Milwaukee Valley. And if I remember history right, Governor Earl opposed that in part because he saw a long, drawn-out fight between the tribes to perhaps leapfrog over each other for more lucrative sites. And we're kind of in that battle now.
Is there a pretty solid general consensus among tribes that casinos are something they want to have, that these are good for the economic well-being?
Well, around the United States, you've got 555 tribal entities. Less than half of them engage in gaming activities. So some tribes have made conscious decision that they're not going to engage in that. But the revenues generated are used for things like health care, housing, education, and any tribe would want those kinds of revenue streams. So when you look at the needs of the Menominee Nation and you know that their casino does not generate the kind of revenue in the face of state cutbacks, in the face of federal cutbacks that have gone under in the last almost 15 years now, shrinking federal dollars, shrinking federal state dollars. Tribes are looking for alternative revenue streams, and casinos are a very, very good lucrative revenue stream as compared to some other marginal businesses. So it is needed, and it's justified to a great extent by the need. The question of whether or not the politics will allow to carry the day is yet to be made. It's in the governor's hand at this particular point.
It's in the governor's hand. What do you see as the timeline now moving forward?
Well, he's got 60 days to make a decision. We'll hear about it. You know, I'm hopeful for the Menominee. I can be on both sides of this particular argument. There are always double-edged swords with gambling and cigarettes and some of the other activities that tribes are constrained in terms of making their income off of that are lucrative business projects like this. I'm expecting that the governor will probably wait until the last minute to make his decision, and I'm hopeful the Menominee tribe. I hope that the Menominee tribe can work with the Potawatomis to try to figure out a way to get through this dispute that I think nobody in Wisconsin is going to like.
Paul, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Paul DeMain, producer for IndianCountryTV.com.
Coming up next, we'll hear why Martin Luther King Jr.'s I Have a Dream speech has stood the test of time.
This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.
Thanks, Kristen. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. This week, Wednesday, marks the anniversary of the 1963 March on Washington. We're covering different angles of that watershed day in American history this week on Central Time.
Martin Luther King Jr.'s I Have a Dream speech has gone down in history as one of the greatest of all time. Our guest today says listening to it now and again is good for the soul. Stephen Lucas is a communication arts professor at the UW-Madison and author of the book Words of a Century about the top 100 American speeches. And Stephen, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Now, you've said that listening to Dr. King's I Have a Dream speech is good for the soul. Why do you say that?
Well, for various reasons. One is the issue that he's dealing with, which is the issue of civil rights and the issue of the color line is, as W.B. Du Bois said, the central moral issue in American history. But the other thing about this speech, apart from the importance of the setting and the magnificent content, is just simply listening to King deliver it. You know, we read the text, and sometimes we forget that speeches are meant to be heard rather than just read. And you listen to this speech, and it strikes you with regard to the content. It strikes you with regard to the language, the use of metaphor and simile, and the rhythm and the cadence just gets you pulled into the speech. There's a musical quality to it, and it's a musical quality that King had in a lot of his sermons as an African-American Baptist preacher and in a lot of his other speeches, but they're particularly effective in I Have a Dream.
Well, now that we've heard about the poetry of it, let's take a listen.
So even though we face the difficulties of today and tomorrow, I still have a dream. It is a dream deeply rooted in the American dream. I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal. I have a dream that one day on the red hills of Georgia, the sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners will be able to sit down together at the table of brotherhood. I have a dream that one day, even the state of Mississippi, a state sweltering with the heat of injustice, sweltering with the heat of oppression, will be transformed into an oasis of freedom and justice. I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today.
Now, that's the most famous portion of that speech. How does it make you feel listening to it now? It's 50 years old. How does it sound to your ears?
Well, it sounds wonderful. I've heard this speech literally hundreds of times. Mm. It's like a favorite song. I mean, I know where King's going to speed up. I know where he's going to slow down. I know where he's going to introduce a metaphor. I know where he's going to introduce a particularly compelling phrase. It's like listening to a favorite piece of music. But that's not just because I'm familiar with it. That certainly reinforces the impact for me. But I show this to students in class on a regular basis. They get caught up listening to it, even though the speech was given long before they were born. And again, it's not just the quality of the delivery. It's not just the metaphors and the similes. It's the content, the moral quality of the speech. And it all works together.
Is that what makes it so timeless, that it has this moral core to it that will never grow old, that message is never going to expire?
Oh, absolutely. This speech is the best-known speech in the world. And I do a lot of work in the People's Republic of China. I lecture on this speech there. There are 350, 400 million English language learners in China. And this speech is regularly studied in English language classes in
China.
Really?
How do the Chinese respond to it?
Well, they love the speech. They get caught up in the rhythm and delivery of it as well. But they also love the phrase, "I have a dream." "I have a dream" has become part of the global lexicon. And in that way, it has been stripped away from a detailed knowledge of the quest for racial justice in the United States. So the students in China or Africa or other parts of the world don't know all the details of the history of the American Civil Rights Movement. In point of fact, most white American students don't know all of those details either. But the phrase, "I have a dream," has resonance because it can be related not just to the dreams of a particular group for racial justice, but to the dreams of a nation for progress. We talk about the American dream. Or it can be related to one's personal aspirations.
Now, the surprising thing to me to learn when we spoke earlier was that this was King kind of going off script.
Yes.
For a while. The best part of that speech is King riffing.
Yes, absolutely. And you started in the clip right at the point where he begins the "I Have a Dream" section. And if you view the video of the entire speech, you can see a subtle change in his delivery when he gets to this point. And as you say, the "I Have a Dream" section was not in his written text. He decided to extemporize that. Now, it's not that he thought of the whole thing on the spur of the moment, because he had used the "I have a dream" notion and similar passages in some previous speeches, including one at Detroit a couple of months earlier. But if you look at those other speeches, they don't work as well in a kind of, in a sense of having a timeless quality, because King raises everything here beyond the immediate situation and puts it in more of a universal tone or on a universal plane. And that helps to explain the timeless nature of the speech.
Well, what do you think happened at that moment that made it what it was? Because you said he tried this material in Detroit. It wasn't as transcendent. He does it at this March on Washington, and it's somehow magic. It flies.
Well, there are a couple of stories. One of them is that he was speaking, and the speech was fine up to that point. Mahalia Jackson, the great singer, was in the audience. She had known about the speech in Detroit, and she said, "Martin, tell them about the dream." And one of the stories about the speech is that inspired King to go into the "I Have a Dream" section. When King talked about it himself later, and he only did this on one or two occasions, he didn't mention Mahalia Jackson, but he said he was caught up in the electricity of the moment. There was something special about that day. And he said, very colloquially, "I went into this dream thing that I had done before, the dream thing." And of course, if he hadn't done it, we would have no "I Have a Dream" speech. We'd have the March on Washington speech. We'd have the promissory note speech, to refer to an image that he uses earlier. But we wouldn't have "I Have a Dream."
That's so interesting, because you compared this speech to music before. And as you describe it now, it's almost like he's a jazz musician.
Yes.
And he's got his theme and he goes off and he improvises. Mm-hmm. And that's the part that we remember.
It is. And this is not unusual in the African-American sermonic tradition. And the other thing about that oratorical tradition that King comes from is, just as in the jazz tradition, one would try to display one's skill and one's virtuosity. So just as a jazz performer might try to display his or her virtuosity doing a saxophone riff, for example, an orator would try to display his or her virtuosity doing an oratorical riff. And I don't mean to say that King is engaged in display or demonstration here, mm-hmm. but, you know, he gave thousands of speeches during his career. He would give multiple speeches in a single day during the time of the Civil Rights Movement. This is what he did. He spoke in the same way that a musician played songs.
Well, as you listen to it coming up on this 50th anniversary, how can we hear it with fresh ears now? What advice would you give for really taking it in?
That's a really good question. For people who've not heard the speech before, who don't remember it in its original context, they're always going to hear it with fresh ears. One of the interesting things that some scholars suggest is that we shouldn't hear it with ears that are too fresh. That is to say, we shouldn't forget the context that brought the speech forth. We shouldn't forget that the speech is not talking about "I have a dream" in a commercial sense, but is talking about "I have a dream" with regard to a specific movement for equal rights for a specific group of people.
Oh, well, it's just wonderful to hear it again through your eyes. Professor Lucas, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks.
We've been talking to Stephen Lucas. He's a professor of communication arts at the UW-Madison.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll hear from a guest who says it's time to reignite the protest tradition of the March on Washington today.
Also, Samantha Shannon is being called the next J.K. Rowling, and tomorrow we'll hear about the first book in her forthcoming series. It's going to have 7 books. The first is called Bone Season.
And don't forget, you can always keep up with what's going on here at Central Time at the Central Time Facebook page. You can share your thoughts while you're there. Also, our Twitter handle is CentralTimeWPR, so check it out.
Coming up after the news, droughts did billions of dollars of damage to crops last year, but our guest says some simple changes can lower the chances of crop loss.
That's coming up next on Central Time here on Wisconsin Public Radio.